Welcome to Words to Live By, a podcast series hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Each week, we will share some of the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. In essence, Words to Live By, made up of radio addresses and speeches he delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. 40 years ago, on April 15, 1982, President Reagan met with reporters in the Oval Office to announce his plans to speak to the United Nations Arms Limitation Conference in June. He also suggested that General Secretary Brezhnev of the Soviet Union would do the same, and he hoped he could meet with the elusive Soviet leader during the conference. Ultimately, Brezhnev did not attend the conference, but sent Andrei Gromyko, the Soviet foreign minister, in his place. Rumors were that Brezhnev was in poor health, and yes, ultimately confirmed by his death 5 months later in November 1982. But just a few days after President Reagan met with those reporters in the Oval Office in April, he felt compelled to report to the American people on his approach, his strong beliefs on the subject of nuclear war, and delivered this radio address on April 17th. It's really an excellent, concise summary and the setup to his speech at the UN, which we'll hear in the second half of this podcast. Let's listen.
My fellow Americans, throughout our history, and particularly in recent years, America's taken on an ever-increasing role as peacemaker, taking the initiative time after time to try to help countries settle their differences peacefully. I don't need to recite the list of diplomatic efforts spanning all administrations in which we've been instrumental in ending war and restoring peace. Yet, there are some who still ask, which nation is the true peacemaker, the United States or the Soviet Union? Well, let us ask them, which country has nearly 100,000 troops trying to occupy the once non-aligned nation of Afghanistan? Which country has tried to crush a spontaneous workers' movement in Poland? And what country has engaged in the most massive arms buildup in history? Or let's put the question another way. What country helped its World War II enemies back on their feet? What country is employing trade, aid, and technology to help the developing peoples of the world and actively seeking to bring peace to the Middle East, the South Atlantic, and to Southern Africa? The answer is clear, and it should give us both pride and hope in America. Today, I know there are a great many people who are pointing to the unimaginable horror of nuclear war. I welcome that concern. Those who've governed America throughout the nuclear age, and we who govern it today, have had to recognize that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. So to those who protest against nuclear war, I can only say, I'm with you. Like my predecessors, it is now my responsibility to do my utmost to prevent such a war. No one feels more than I the need for peace. Throughout the first half of my lifetime, the entire world was engaged in war, or in recovering from war, or in preparing for war. Since the end of World War II, there's not been another world conflict, but there have been and are wars going on in various other parts of the world. This stretch of 37 years since World War II has been the result of our maintaining a balance of power between the United States and the Soviet Union, and between the strategic nuclear capabilities of either side. As long as this balance has been maintained, both sides have been given an overwhelming incentive for peace. In the 1970s, the United States altered that balance by, in effect, unilaterally restraining our own military defenses while the Soviet Union engaged in an unprecedented buildup of both its conventional and nuclear forces. As a result, the military balance which permitted us to maintain the peace is now threatened. If steps are not taken to modernize our defense, the United States will progressively lose the ability to deter the Soviet Union from employing force or threats of force against us and against our allies. It would be wonderful if we could restore our balance with the Soviet Union without increasing our own military power. And ideally, it would be a long step in ensuring peace if we could have significant and verifiable reductions of arms on both sides. But let's not fool ourselves. The Soviet Union will not come to any conference table bearing gifts. Soviet negotiators will not make unilateral concessions. To achieve parity, we must make it plain that we have the will to achieve parity by our own effort. Many have been attracted to the idea of a nuclear freeze. Well, that would be fine if we were equal in strategic capability. We're not. We cannot accept an agreement which perpetuates current disparities. The current level of nuclear forces is too high on both sides. It must be the objective of any negotiations on arms control to reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons. Since World War II, the United States has attempted to get Soviet agreement to such reductions countless times. We began back when we alone had such weapons. We were never able to persuade the Soviet Union to join in such an understanding, even when we proposed turning all nuclear material and information over to an international body, and when we were the only nation that had nuclear weapons. We're preparing a new arms reduction effort with regard to strategic nuclear forces and are already in negotiations in Geneva on intermediate-range missiles threatening Europe. Our objective in these talks is for the elimination of such missiles on the strategic nuclear forces. We will aim on those at substantial reductions on both sides, leading to equal and verifiable limits. We'll make every effort to reach an agreement that will reduce the possibility of nuclear war. If we can do this, perhaps one day we can achieve a relationship with the Soviet Union which doesn't depend upon nuclear deterrence to secure Soviet restraint. I invite the Soviet Union to take such a step with us. And I ask you, the American people, to support our efforts at negotiating an end to this threat of doomsday which hangs over the world. Thank you. God bless you.
We'll be right back to hear what he stated with strength and resolve to the UN in June 1982, 40 years ago, right after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit ReaganFoundation.org/give. That's ReaganFoundation.org/give.
Now, back to the story. On June 17, 1982, President Ronald Reagan addressed the United Nations for the first time. So, recall that when the United Nations was formed in the lingering glow of the U.S.-Soviet alliance in World War II, Reagan was an ardent U.N. supporter, as many war-weary Americans embraced the United Nations' lofty goals of worldwide peace. This optimism faded rapidly during the Cold War, when Soviet vetoes in the Security Council demonstrated the organization's limited ability to resolve disputes when the superpowers differed. In the 1960s, Citizen Reagan said, "We cannot safely rest the case of freedom with the United Nations as it is presently constructed, not until reconstruction of this organization puts realistic power in the hands of those nations which must, through size and strength, be ultimately responsible for world order. Can we submit questions affecting our national interests to the UN and be confident of a fair hearing?" Ronald Reagan's behavior as president reflected these views. He named an able and tough-minded conservative, Jean Kirkpatrick, as ambassador to the United Nations. He pulled the United States out of UNESCO, cut off U.S. contributions to the UN Fund for Population Activities, and encouraged congressional efforts to force the UN budget reform by withholding U.S. dues. Then, in 1982, President Reagan's first speech to the United Nations was described as the most harshly worded address ever delivered to the world body by an American president. He accused the Soviets of tyranny, aggression, atrocities, and ruthless repression, and urged Soviet acceptance of a U.S. agenda for peace. That day, he did not mention his dream of getting rid of all nuclear weapons, but he did severely criticize the Soviet Union. Our 40th president focused especially on the time the Soviets had an opportunity to eliminate nuclear weapons and rejected it. In his diary notes after the speech, President Reagan recorded that Gromyko did not applaud at all and glowered when he said some blunt things about the Soviet Union that Reagan believed needed saying. The president noted his remarks were not well received by the large segment, which usually voted against the U.S. and with the USSR. So, this is a long speech. We've edited it to focus on his remarks directed to the Soviet Union. After a brief intro, we'll head to the section that rocked the Soviets' world. Let's listen.
Mr. Secretary General, Mr. President, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, I speak today as both a citizen of the United States and of the world. I come with the heartfelt wishes of my people for peace, bearing honest proposals, and looking for genuine progress. Dag Hammarskjöld said 24 years ago this month, "We meet in a time of peace, which is no peace." His words are as true today as they were then. More than 100 disputes have disturbed the peace among nations since World War II. And today, the threat of nuclear disaster hangs over the lives of all our people. The Bible tells us there will be a time for peace, but so far this century, mankind has failed to find it. The United Nations is dedicated to world peace, and its charter clearly prohibits the international use of force. Yet the tide of belligerence continues to rise. The Charter's influence has weakened even in the 4 years since the first special session on disarmament. We must not only condemn aggression, we must enforce the dictates of our Charter and resume the struggle for peace. The record of history is clear. Citizens of the United States resort to force reluctantly and only when they must. Our foreign policy, as President Eisenhower once said, is not difficult to state. We are for peace, first, last, and always, for very simple reasons. We know that only in a peaceful atmosphere, a peace with justice, one in which we can be confident, can America prosper as we have known prosperity in the past, he said. He said, to those who challenge the truth of those words, let me point out at the end of World War II, we were the only undamaged industrial power in the world. Our military supremacy was unquestioned. We had harnessed the atom and had the ability to unleash its destructive force anywhere in the world. In short, we could have achieved world domination, but that was contrary to the character of our people. Instead, we wrote a new chapter in the history of mankind. In the nuclear era, the major powers bear a special responsibility to ease these sources of conflict and to refrain from aggression. And that's why we're so deeply concerned by Soviet conduct. Since World War II, the record of tyranny has included Soviet violation of the Yalta agreements leading to domination of Eastern Europe, symbolized by the Berlin Wall, a grim, gray monument to repression that I visited just a week ago. It includes the takeovers of Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Afghanistan, and the ruthless repression of the proud people of Poland. Soviet-sponsored guerrillas and terrorists are at work in Central and South America, in Africa, the Middle East, in the Caribbean, and in Europe, violating human rights and unnerving the world with violence. Communist atrocities in Southeast Asia, Afghanistan, and elsewhere continue to shock the free world as refugees escape to tell of their horror. The decade of so-called détente witnessed the most massive Soviet buildup of military power in history. They increased their defense spending by 40%, while American defense actually declined in the same real terms. Soviet aggression and support for violence around the world have eroded the confidence needed for arms negotiations. While we exercised unilateral restraint, they forged ahead and today possess nuclear and conventional forces far in excess of an adequate deterrent capability. Soviet oppression is not limited to the countries they invade. At the very time the Soviet Union is trying to manipulate the peace movement in the West, it is stifling a budding peace movement at home. In Moscow, banners are scuttled, buttons are snatched, and demonstrators are arrested
when even a few people dare to speak about their fears. Eleanor Roosevelt, one of our first ambassadors to this body, reminded us that the high-sounding words of tyrants stand in bleak contradiction to their deeds. Their promises, she said, are in deep contrast to their performances. My country learned a bitter lesson in this century. The scourge of tyranny cannot be stopped with words alone. So we have embarked on an effort to renew our strength that had fallen dangerously low. We refuse to become weaker while potential adversaries remain committed to their imperialist adventures. My people have sent me here today to speak for them as citizens of the world, which they truly are. For we Americans are drawn from every nationality represented in this chamber today. We understand that men and women of every race and creed can and must work together for peace. We stand ready to take the next steps down the road of cooperation through verifiable arms reduction. Let me repeat, we need deeds, not words, to convince us of Soviet sincerity should they choose to join us on this path. Since the end of World War II, the United States has been the leader in serious disarmament and arms control proposals. In 1946, in what became known as the Baruch Plan, the United States submitted a proposal for control of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy by an international authority. The Soviets rejected this plan. In 1955, President Eisenhower made his open skies proposal, under which the United States and the Soviet Union would have exchanged blueprints of military establishments and provided for aerial reconnaissance. The Soviets rejected this plan. In 1963, the Limited Test Ban Treaty came into force. This treaty ended nuclear weapons testing in the atmosphere, outer space, or underwater by participating nations. In 1970, the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons took effect. The United States played a major role in this key effort to prevent the spread of nuclear explosives and to provide for international safeguards on civil nuclear activities. My country remains deeply committed to those objectives today and to strengthening the non-proliferation framework. This is essential to international security. In the early 1970s, again at United States urging, agreements were reached between the United States and the USSR providing for ceilings on some categories of weapons. They could have been more meaningful if Soviet actions had shown restraint and commitment to stability at lower levels of force. The United Nations designated the 1970s as the first disarmament decade, but good intentions were not enough. In reality, that 10-year period included an unprecedented buildup in military weapons and the flaring of aggression and use of force in almost every region of the world. We are now in the second disarmament decade. The task at hand is to assure civilized behavior among nations, to unite behind an agenda of peace. Over the past 7 months, the United States has put forward a broad-based, comprehensive series of proposals to reduce the risk of war. We have proposed 4 major points as an agenda for peace. Elimination of land-based intermediate-range missiles. A 1/3 reduction in strategic ballistic missile warheads. A substantial reduction in NATO and Warsaw Pact ground and air forces. And new safeguards to reduce the risk of accidental war. We urge the Soviet Union today to join with us in this quest. We must act not for ourselves alone, but for all mankind. On November 18th of last year, I announced United States objectives in arms control agreements. They must be equitable and militarily significant. They must stabilize forces at lower levels, and they must be verifiable. The United States and its allies have made specific, reasonable, and equitable proposals. In February, our negotiating team in Geneva offered the Soviet Union a draft treaty on intermediate-range nuclear forces. We offered to cancel deployment of our Pershing II ballistic missiles and ground-launched cruise missiles in exchange for Soviet elimination of the SS-20, SS-4, and SS-5 missiles. This proposal would eliminate with one stroke those systems about which both sides have expressed the greatest concern. The United States is also looking forward to beginning negotiations on strategic arms reductions with the Soviet Union in less than 2 weeks. We will work hard to make these talks an opportunity for real progress in our quest for peace. Let me stress that for agreements to work, both sides must be able to verify compliance. The building of mutual confidence in compliance can only be achieved through greater openness. We are also pressing the need for effective verification provisions in agreements banning chemical weapons. The use of chemical and biological weapons has long been viewed with revulsion by civilized nations. No peacemaking institution can ignore the use of those dread weapons and still live up to its mission. The need for a truly effective and verifiable chemical weapons agreement has been highlighted by recent events. The Soviet Union and their allies are violating the Geneva Protocol of 1925, related rules of international law, and the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. There is conclusive evidence that the Soviet government has provided toxins for use in Laos and Kampuchea and are themselves using chemical weapons against freedom fighters in Afghanistan. We have repeatedly protested to the Soviet government, as well as to the governments of Laos and Vietnam, their use of chemical and toxin weapons. We call upon them now to grant full and free access to their countries or to territories they control so that United Nations experts can conduct an effective, independent investigation to verify cessation of these horrors. The amount and type of military spending by a country is important for the world to know as a measure of its intentions and the threat that country may pose to its neighbors. The Soviet Union and other closed societies go to extraordinary lengths to hide their true military spending, not only from other nations, but from their own people. This practice contributes to distrust and fear about their intentions. Today, the United States proposes an international conference on military expenditures to build on the work of this body in developing a common system for accounting and reporting. We urge the Soviet Union in particular to join this effort in good faith, to revise the universally discredited official figures it publishes, and to join with us in giving the world a true account of the resources we allocate to our armed forces. Last Friday in Berlin, I said that I would leave no stone unturned in the effort to reinforce peace and lessen the risk of war. It's been clear to me steps should be taken to improve mutual communication, confidence, and lessen the likelihood of misinterpretation. I have therefore directed the exploration of ways to increase understanding and communication between the United States and the Soviet Union in times of peace and of crisis. We will approach the Soviet Union with proposals for reciprocal exchanges in such areas as advance notification of major strategic exercises that otherwise might be misinterpreted, advance notification of ICBM launches within as well as beyond national boundaries, and an expanded exchange of strategic forces data. While substantial information on U.S. activities and forces in these areas already is provided, I believe that jointly and regularly sharing information would represent a qualitative improvement in the strategic nuclear environment and would help reduce the chance of misunderstandings. I call upon the Soviet Union to join the United States in exploring these possibilities to build confidence, and I ask for your support of our efforts. One of the major items before this conference is the development of a comprehensive program of disarmament. We support the effort to chart a course of realistic and effective measures in the quest for peace. I have come to this hall to call for international recommitment to the basic tenet of the United Nations Charter, that all members practice tolerance and live together in peace as good neighbors under the rule of law, forsaking armed force as a means of settling disputes between nations. America urges you to support the agenda for peace that I have outlined today. We ask you to reinforce the bilateral and multilateral arms control negotiations between members of NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and to rededicate yourselves to maintaining international peace and security and removing threats to peace. We who have signed the UN Charter have pledged to refrain from the threat or use of force against the territory or independence of any state. In these times when more and more lawless acts are going unpunished, as some members of this very body show a growing disregard for the UN Charter, the peace-loving nations of the world must condemn aggression and pledge again to act in a way that is worthy of the ideals that we have endorsed. Let us finally make the Charter live. The United Nations, Hammarskjöld said, was born out of the cataclysms of war. It should justify the sacrifices of all those who have died for freedom and justice. It is our duty to the past. Hammarskjöld said, and it is our duty to the future, so to serve both our nations and the world. As both patriots of our nations and the hope of all the world, let those of us assembled here in the name of peace deepen our understandings, renew our commitment to the rule of law, and take new and bolder steps to calm an uneasy world. Can any delegate here deny that in so doing, he would be doing what the people, the rank and file of his own country or her own country, want him or her to do? Isn't it time for us to really represent the deepest, most heartfelt yearnings of all of our people? Let no nation abuse this common longing to be free of fear. We must not manipulate our people by playing upon their nightmares. We must serve mankind through genuine disarmament. With God's help, we can secure life and freedom for generations to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Words to Live By podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of Words to Live By come out every Tuesday. Like what you hear? Check out our A Reagan Forum podcast featuring great speeches delivered at the Reagan Library. New episodes drop every Thursday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan 40 on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.